welcome to the Court ODR Podcast.
Welcome, everyone, to the Court ODR Podcast. My name is Colin Rule, CEO of ODR.com. And I'm delighted today to have my friend Catherine to talk about an email exchange that just recently took place that I thought surfaced some great, great topics for us to discuss. So, Catherine, thank you so much for joining today.
It's my pleasure, Colin.
Why don't you say a little bit about yourself before we get started?
Yeah, my name is Catherine Altenader, and I, for 10 years, led the Self-Represented Litigation Network, and before that was in Alaska and started the country's first remote self-help center that went all phone and internet in 2001. So I've been working with pro se litigants now for 20 some odd years, building online environments for them, but then also in the last 10 years, working to help bring justice system professionals together who work on issues around self-represented litigants. So whether that's services and legal aid, the courts, the private bar, how technology integrates, librarians, and so forth. So it's just a delight to get to talk to you about this.
Absolutely. Absolutely a delight. And I thought the email that you posted, and now SRLN is hosted, Margaret is helping with that at Stanford, right? So I highly recommend that everybody sign up for the mailing list because it's under your management. It has become, I think, the most vital and exciting conversation around access to justice in the U.S. So, but this email that you posted was a really interesting point, and it really focused on what do we call people who are coming into the court system? And I thought you made some really interesting points. I mean, Alaska obviously has been on the leading edge of this for a long time, and you and Stacy, I think, are largely responsible for some of that forward thinking. But you said when you were first hired by the Alaska court system, the administrator renamed the clerk's office to customer service, which I think is a really, and again, as a Silicon Valley guy, that really resonates with me. But tell me a little bit about how that went over.
Yeah, well, right about the time I started, so this is in 2001, Stephanie Cole, who was the administrator at that time, and a strong advocate for the courts, who I think at that time was leading the COSCA side of CCJ COSCA and doing right. Some really important white papers on how courts might begin to serve self-represented litigants. And so she, you know, and it's something so small. I mean, I remember these little signs that you know, had been printed out on paper, cut in half and laminated. And she walked around and literally like shoved them on people's desks and was like, we are now a customer service. Like, that's what we do. And, you know, there was a lot of grumbling, like what, you know, oh, what's this stupid little sign on the desk? But, you know, because like they're still doing the same job. But I could see how when we grounded conversations in serving the public. And so we were, and I was just starting the self-help center at that time. And my staff came from the clerk's office. And being able to talk about the people we spoke to as customers really changed the interaction, right? And sure. I make the point in the post that, you know, you're as a customer between the relationship between a customer and a customer service agent is more problem solving. You know, you have this common goal of a resolution,
that's right.
Whether it's trying to find the right dress or the right form, rather than one side trying to extract something from another. And I think that obviously that improved the public's experience with the court, but it also improved, I think, the job satisfaction for the court employees who before, I you know, there was this culture of like somebody's trying to drag something out of you, right?
Right, like, right, sure.
We're like this wall that's going to hold them back. As opposed to, oh, I get to just sort of be a helpful, constructive problem solver. Of course, you can't do that if you don't have resources, you know, things like forms and instructions. So that's why content is so critical to be able to do it.
Sure.
But yeah, no, I think it helped everybody.
Well, it's interesting. So the nature of the grumbling, you think, at the beginning was people just, that wasn't the way they saw their role in advance of the word customer being sort of thrust into the discussion, right? What do you, and you said you thought they were kind of holding back the tide. I mean, yeah. I do think, again, as someone who, I've run big customer service teams, and, you know, there is sort of a stereotype of, on the business side, quote unquote, the customer is always right. You know, we need to delight the customer. We have to make sure they have a good experience. But of course, that's not always the case in the court. Sometimes people are coming for unhappy things. So it's hard to get somebody to be delighted by a situation that they're probably not very happy to be involved in the first place. But what do you think the nature of the grumbling was?
It was more along the lines of, it just seems silly, you know, because the job had
trivial, right?
Yeah. You know, like, what's this window dressing? What's this going to do? Right?
Right.
We have this little laminated card now. Like, what do we do with that?
Yeah.
But as, you know, training and things like that changed, and of course, you know, people, overwhelming majority of people coming to court, everybody, in fact, probably other than the people getting married, are coming for something sad has happened, but the court staff isn't responsible for the sadness that's underlying that, right? That, and what they can be is part of the solution of helping that person come up with options to move forward and to navigate that system.
Absolutely.
So yeah, no, I think it just, they thought, you know, and the element of it didn't sound as official. Right.
Like, I see that. I can see that. Right.
Sounds very official. And it, you know, this is a general pushback that often people have against plain language and all of that, that we have to sound, you know, very austere and prestigious. And this is the court. And, you know, there has to be, you know, sort of this formality. And customer service didn't sound formal and fancy enough.
Interesting.
And what would that undermine their authority? And I think over time they came to see that in fact it freed them to have a different kind of authority.
Well, and I do think words matter. You know, I don't want to get all Michel Foucault on everybody, but you know, the language you use to describe something shapes the way you think about that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when someone is using a certain term and then you come in and suggest a different term, I've had this, and when I've tried to do some, you know, process change stuff, people fight back. They're like, well, why, you know, why this, does this matter? Like, why are you changing the word? You're not changing the process. You're just changing the language. But over time, as you say, you can see the nudge that comes from that new language and orientation. And I do agree with you. I think people that are coming into the courts, when they're called a litigant or something like that, they've never been a litigant before. They don't really know what that means, you know, but the court knows what it means. And you come in and say, well, you're a litigant and this is the role that litigants play. And I'm a court clerk and this is the role that I play. But when you say customer, well, everybody has an experience of being a customer. And, you know, as you say, that's often a good thing. And I like that problem solving orientation. I always say that to my customer service reps. I said, look, it's not you versus them. It's not a negotiation. We're aligned trying to find a solution, right? Like if we, both of us are on the same side of the rope pulling, it's not that we're on either side of the rope pulling against each other. And I think the language can do a lot to change that. What was the language before it was customer?
I think it was just litigant. I mean, I don't know.
Litigant. Yeah, it was a long time ago, 2001.
Yeah, well, and I didn't work for the court before. I literally started when this came in. You know, like the idea that they were going to have a self-help center. And
perfect timing, yeah.
And customer service, all these things were well wrapped up in one another. But, you know, it's this, and that didn't change, right? I mean, just because the clerk's office became customer service.
Sure.
Didn't change the fact that everybody had, you know, their own language. And, you know, as I think we saw in that string that was on A2JN listserv, you know, it's litigant, it's pro per, it's pro se. I'd never, before I worked for the courts, I'd never heard the term pro per. I was like,
yeah. That seems very lawyery to me. You know, that's something lawyers know what that means and no one else does.
But I knew pro se. I just didn't know pro per. I was like, and so I think, you know, they, whatever role the different court staff played, they used different language. And I tried to make that point in the post is that even though we can find a word that we think accomplishes all the things we've been discussing,
sure,
in terms of improvements, we still have to use the language that's how the person is going to be addressed by folks in the system. So, you know, judges say parties, like that's usually.
Yeah. And I say parties, I don't want to say that dispute resolution is doing any better than the courts. Cause I definitely say cases and parties. Oh, we have a case, we have a dispute. Who are the parties to the dispute?
Right.
But I think I like customer a lot better. The other question I want to ask is, you know, and I think John posted a follow-up to your message saying, you know, this is tied to the whole UPL issue, right? Because if somebody is a party or if somebody's a litigant and I'm a clerk, I have, you know, they have to figure out the process themselves. I'm administering my part of the process. But if they're a customer, then sometimes you, you know, you want to give them a little help. You want to give them a little guidance, right? If we're in problem solving mode. And so that sort of gets to the whole issue about, well, what's appropriate for a clerk to say to a litigant as opposed to a customer? So I think there's an interesting relationship between those two concepts.
Yeah. And I think when we talk about UPL in the courts, it's very different than when we talk about UPL outside the courts, because that is the grounding of, you know, John's seminal article in, I think, 95 or 96 of distinguishing legal information from legal advice.
Right.
Is that in practice in the courts, the ethical control is whether you're neutral and impartial. And is this something that you can distribute equally to all people? So if you, you know, I'm an advocate of people taking an educational model to thinking, you know, you, if you could go down to your local community college and teach a class that says, this is how it all works, why can't we do that in the building?
Sure.
So that is UPL, telling somebody this is how it all works. But it has to be distributed equally, because a key piece, I think, of the UPL analysis is, are you giving advantage to, you know, one, are you being an advocate to one side?
And absolutely.
If you're being a customer service agent that's giving everybody the same help, I think you get in practice, both in practice and in policy, UPL doesn't really come into play. And so this is a funny thing about UPL and people who, you know, like me, who had the really the good fortune to work in the sort of early golden years of courts developing self-help. It wasn't until I started working on the national level that UPL even crossed my radar, because as long as I was neutral and impartial
right
in the court, I was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that John talked about, you know, the sign on the wall. It says we cannot provide any legal information. And I've worked with a lot of courts. We walk in right there. It's the biggest sign that you see. And he's like, I really am trying to get rid of that sign. You know, one of the things we talk about in dispute resolution, because there's a lot of talk about neutrality. Is anybody really truly neutral? And is neutral something that you want? Like if you have a customer service rep who's helping you solve a problem, is neutrality a helpful thing, or is it kind of off-putting, you know, for someone to say, well, you know, one of the things Ken Cloke, who's a big thinker in mediation, he's talked about omnipartiality. So instead of, you know, impartiality, we're omnipartial. We want everybody to get a good outcome. So, right. You know, we're going to try. And I think that's a good orientation for a customer service rep, right? Like, look, I want to help you and I want to help you. I'm not going to give an advantage to anybody, but I want to provide as much help as I can to the two of you within the bounds of not providing an advantage to one party or the other party. So that's kind of an interesting orientation too. Like a customer service rep can be omnipartial, where a customer orientation can make you, I want to help everybody as much as I can, while, as you say, staying away from putting my thumb on the scale.
Yeah. And I think keeping in mind too, that neutrality, passivity is not neutrality.
Right.
Passivity, and that is often how neutrality is interpreted in our sector. Passivity always favors the bully, always favors the stronger party. It is the farthest thing from being neutral.
Totally. Well, so, there's a great quote from Desmond Tutu. It says, you know, if the elephant is standing on the mouse's tail and you say you're neutral, the mouse does not appreciate your neutrality. So, yeah.
So, that's where I think the thing about somebody coming at it a customer service perspective is you kind of chat your customer up, right? You figure out what they want. Do they want a dress or do they want pants, right? You're not.
Yeah, right.
And you know, what's the weather like? And, you know, you find out some information so that, you know, if the goal is to walk out of the store with some clothes, what are the right clothes? If the goal is to walk out with the right form, you're going to have to understand a little bit about their scenario, and that engagement is not a partial activity. It's it's fact finding, right? To figure out how to be constructive and have engaged neutrality. Asking questions is I think something that people, you know, and Richard Zorza wrote quite a bit about this whole idea on engaged neutrality and what it's like and how it creates transparency. And then we understand what's happening. And part of what happens when we have you know, neutrality that is in fact not neutrality is that it's just opaque, right? And so
right.
That's that. So anyhow,
I like that. I like that engaged neutrality. I haven't heard that before. I'm going to go look that up. That's a great frame. The last question I want to talk to you about, because you touch on this at the end of your post, you talked about the term SRL, for self-represented litigants as opposed to unrepresented litigants. And I've been hearing, you know, dialogue back and forth about that, but not for using that with the parties, not for using that with the customers, using that internally so that we have clarity around who it is that we're working with. But because you say that the term unrepresented seems like a very non-neutral way to talk about people and inadvertently validates in the mind of professionals the biases that exist against SRLs. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because you probably thought about that more than anybody.
Yeah, well, and in this, I would, you know, just also refer to John's post, who really, you know, was there on the ground as they fought for using the term self-represented.
Sure.
And that it, you know, as he wrote, it emphasizes the litigant's capability rather than their incapability. You can represent yourself. You can do that. It conveys agency. Mm-hmm. I think the more we do to get the justice system professionals to look at the public like that, right, the better, right? And
right.
I think that's you know, the unending bias against people that don't have lawyers, that somehow if you have a lawyer, you're a better person than if you don't have a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's certainly that alone, much less than, you know, the whole issue of you, there's no way you can navigate the system without a lawyer, or there's no reason to expect that you can. I mean, there's just so many. And I think Victor Quintanilla's research on the bias that's operating here and the doing represented status is really significant. And something that as professionals thinking, you know, we often think about, well, how are we going to just manage these people, as opposed to, let's talk about how the language affects us. I mean, it goes mm-hmm. to the mm-hmm. of our conversation. How did customer service affect the court staff? How does using the term unrepresented party, you know, right away, that just sounds like somebody you're supposed to disregard.
Right.
You know, they're running.
Well, you're defining them by what they're not, right? Like, yeah.
You're totally. Just running amok. I mean, we can't have people running amok. It's like an unsupervised child, right? Not something, but it has that tone, right? It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely got, you know, it's looking down on people. It's saying that they're just not qualified to be doing this on their own. And they, not only are they absolutely qualified, you know, I mean, these are people problems, right? That have legal solutions, but they are, and they, people can manage their lives. They're trying and, they
absolutely.
Them. And I think the paternalistic view of them as just unsupervised children is very harmful to the people doing the work, because then it reinforces again that these people are extracting something from me. If they were only represented, I wouldn't have to do XYZ, right?
Well, I wouldn't have to explain this or that or this term, because presumably they'd have someone there that speaks the same language as me. But again, it loops me back to customer, because customer, you know, nobody comes in and, you know, at the front door of Target and says, well, where's your representative here? You know, how are you going to be able to navigate the shelves? It's like, no. Everyone is a self-represented customer, you know? So using that term, you're not defining someone with a lack right out of the box.
Right.
You know, so I think it really, really is interesting. And I want to learn more about some of the research around the stigma, too, because that's not something I've heard about. But I so appreciate you sharing the time today to think through this. I think this is a great ongoing conversation. I think one of the reasons why I resonated so much with your post is because I agree so strongly. And I think it's just because I spent a lot of time in the private sector and customer is the word here. So it's a little bit weird when I come into the courts and there's all these other terms for people coming in. And I love that lens. I don't know if it's if it provides total clarity, but it definitely, it's a different way of looking at people who are trying to just find solutions to problems. It's like, well,
And I would add too, I mean, when I train on this, I often draw from the customer service literature of like training people to do customer service. So, right, part of the framework of customer service is considering their before, during, and after experience. And if we apply that to what we're doing in the courts in terms of the resources we provide and how we do it, so what is their before experience? You know, that's what's on your website or your, you know, the other people in the community who are talking about what you're going to need for X, Y, and Z. So the more education we front load and get you ready for your customer service experience, then you have the during the actual event.
Right.
And afterwards, whether you have to, you know, there's an enforcement action or there's some follow-up things that you need to do, that we're thinking of the entire arc of the experience, not just that moment when they're in the quote unquote clerk's office saying, what form do I need?
If the
court thinks about, and all of our institutions, legal aid as well, like the incomplete arc of the public's experience as they resolve their legal issue, it will transform how you put together your resources, how you engage in them. Think about, you know, I mean, as an ODR person, right? If there's so much pre-education to do before somebody really is ready to mediate, right?
Totally. Like,
there is this huge chunk of before that goes on there, but even before that, if the before education that's readily available says one of the options for resolving this conflict is some kind of alternative dispute resolution, whether that's online or, you know, with people helping you, then there's things you can do with judges. And then there's, you know, like things that you might do with other actors that are useful for you, depending on your problem. So we start putting into the minds of people the options of resolution. That's the before, right? And then once they're in locus, like doing the thing, then they, you know, just as a pedagogical issue, like we get to repeat that again. So you've got four options of like how we resolve this. And now you're not telling them that for the first time. Now they're like, oh yeah, I remember reading about that, right? And so then they, you know, just the stress and the cognitive load of everything going on, like now they're able to actually use the information you're giving them because it's not the first time they've heard it. And that's, I think that's why that before piece is so important. But the, as you know, the literature on customer service, I mean, it's a discipline, it's a profession.
Oh, sure. Yeah. There are people who spend 40, 50 years working in customer service. Yeah. Yeah, and it's evolving all the time too, as expectations on customers are changing.
And I think, you know, there's an article from the Harvard Business Review I often use to train on that shows like how the level of engagement and styles of customer service agents, of, you know, of being very passive or proactive, or, you know, what you know people need to do, especially like you know, customer service like online help, you know, like we're calling somebody, a helpline or something like that.
Right.
You know, and as we, as you know, the whole notion of escalating problems, right, and like having a very intentional way you do that. And so I think it's very helpful in so many different ways of improving and giving a framework that is useful and operation, you know, operative. You can do, you know, there are people that have done this, right? We can learn from others.
Absolutely.
But the one caveat I'll put in, and this was in my post, and I've heard this from folks, if we call people customers and the system doesn't treat them as customers, then that just defends the heck out of them.
Absolutely. And actually, I wrote a book for the ABA called Online Dispute Resolution and the Future of Customer Service, Customer Support. And it was really focused on exactly as you say. You don't want to give somebody a lot of bells and whistles. You want to make a promise and you want to meet the promise. Yes. And when the customer service teams that I ran at eBay and PayPal, we tracked obsessively something we called NPS, Net Promoter Score, which tracked, and it was one question, how likely, you know, would you be to recommend what you just went through to a friend or family member if they had a similar type of situation? And it was 1 to 10. And we did that every single engagement. We gathered all that data and we talked about the whole customer journey. Because the other thing is, it's not like there's one engagement. They come in with one problem and they get a solution and that's the end. Because they may be back again, right? So you have to think about how all of these customer journeys connect. But I love this orientation. I think the reason why I wanted to reach out and talk to you more about this, Catherine, is because I agree so strongly with it. And I think there is a lot that we can learn from thinking about it this way. And I'm not saying that customer service has all the answers. Trust me, there's a lot of people, you know, they call up that 1-800 number for Comcast and immediately, you know, you just feel the anxiety settle in to your spine because it's a painful process. So it's not that customer service has all the answers, but that orientation of joint problem solving with your customer, I think is a really, really interesting one, especially as we move into this new, you know, AI world where, mm-hmm. you know, people do, they are bringing the expectations of customer service interactions to their interactions with the courts. So, you know, we need to understand all the value we can squeeze out of the customer service orange and then bring to the work that we do. And I thought your post just did a great, great job laying that out. So I so appreciate you chatting with me today. This was fantastic.
Thank you. It's been an absolute privilege, and I really admire the work that you do. So thank you for having me.
The Court ODR Podcast is brought to you by ODR.com. To learn more about ODR.com products and services, please visit us at ODR.com.